I will, sorry. You can.
What am I supposed to do?
Oh, this, yes, I see what you mean now.
Expect a clean face on it, can't do that.
I think we can go ahead and get started with the morning session. So we have two talks on cosmology, the first of which is by George Ellis.
Okay, well, we've heard about black holes, but the second great success of general relativity was cosmology. And the application of general relativity to cosmology led to a number of radical new ideas about the nature of the universe, in particular the fact that the universe might have had a beginning. Well, in fact, the idea that it could have evolved, and then the idea it could have had a beginning, and also raised some philosophical issues that are with us today. And two main themes run through this: the issue of the relation of physics to cosmology, and the issue of the testability of theories about the universe and the large. Underlying this is the uniqueness of the universe, which makes cosmology a particular subject from a philosophical side, but I won't really talk about that. Now, the major events in the relation of GR to cosmology, I'm going to give you what I regard as the seven major things. Firstly, Einstein, 1917. General relativity gives a cosmological model, and you must remember that since the time of Newton, people had failed to get a cosmological model. The first cosmological model was Einstein. It was static because everybody knew the universe was static. Nevertheless, it was a cosmological model. Then, Lemaître, 1927, expanding universe. You might ask, why don't I put in Friedman? And the answer is Friedman just had a mathematical model, whereas Lemaître had a cosmology. And I think that's a really important distinction. Okay, but you've got a cosmology, you've got a test. Well, sorry, the next one was Lifshitz, 46, perturbations of the expanding universe. So Lemaître had the background model, and it's really important that was Lifshitz, the perturbations of the expanding model. The model has to be tested, and the person that I particularly identify as pushing the testing program was Sandage, with his systematic observational test program. Now, that program failed because he didn't have standard candles at that time. Nevertheless, he was pushing that particular thing, and he had a famous paper about cosmology. Cosmology, there are just two numbers, Q0 and H0, was at that time. Sachs and Wolff, the cosmic background radiation perturbations, absolutely crucial paper, which laid the foundation for what a huge number of people are doing today. Goethe, the inflationary universe, whether one likes the inflationary universe or not, there's no question whatever. This put a new foundation for most of relativistic cosmology. And then the people who I identify as having done the inflationary fluctuations is Mukhanov and Chibisov. And so those are what I regard as the major seven events in the relation of GR to cosmology, each of them introducing a new kind of thing. And then, of course, currently you put these all together and we have the current kind of synthesis. Now, the issue of physics to cosmology. As to the issue of physics to cosmology, on the one hand, the physical cosmology picture of an evolution of the universe from a hot Big Bang to the present day has offered a series of unifications of ever more fundamental physics with cosmological models and predictions. So unifications have taken place, which I will talk about in a minute. On the other hand, it's led to the spectre of creation of the universe from a state when physics did not apply, or else emerging from a quantum gravity era that we do not understand. And so just as Wheeler emphasized the problem of the final state of collapse, there's an equal problem at the start of the universe. What did it come from? What does it even mean to say it came from something? And so on. Okay, so the first thing is that general relativity, you apply general relativity locally everywhere and it gives you the evolution of the universe as a whole. You have the energy conservation equation and you have the Friedman equation. Through these equations, matter plus local gravity everywhere determines the space-time structure. This determines the history of matter, for example, the temperature-time relation and the density-time relation. That determines how the physics unfolds in the expanding universe. And different equations of state give different evolutions of the universe. So the crucial thing in there is there's pressure in the conservation equation, there's a density, and the whole way the evolution goes depends on the relation between the density and the pressure, which is the conservation equation, and it may be in terms of another hidden variable like a scalar field, which then gives you the density and pressure from the standard relations. Now, the standard model is then tested by many observations, and the first fundamental thing I want to mention, apart from the galaxies I mentioned standard, of course, is the black body spectrum, and this incredible spectrum, black body spectrum, and what it tells us, apart from anything else, it tells us the universe was hot at early times, it tells us there must have been equilibrium at early times, but it also says standard quantum mechanics applies at the time of decoupling. That's a really important statement because cosmology depends on physics being the same everywhere. That is our assumption, otherwise we can't get off the ground, and this confirms that quantum physics held unchanged 13 billion years ago, which is quite an important statement. Nucleosynthesis. Standard nuclear physics applies at the time of nucleosynthesis even earlier. And you have the helium, helium-3, lithium, deuterium production as a function of density, and you find there is one band of density which fits the observations, and that determines the density of baryons in the early universe. You get the key set of observations when, in fact, we did get standard candles finally through the supernova. Decay of the supernova provides a usable standard candles because the maximum brightness is correlated to the decay rate. And with redshifts gives the first reliable detection of nonlinearity. Sandage was trying to detect this for decades and failed. Other people tried. This is, of course, the first one where it works. And showing unexpectedly that the universe is presently accelerating. There's some kind of positive cosmological constant or negative pressure. This is, of course, assuming the Robertson-Walker geometry. If you don't assume a Robertson-Walker geometry, the conclusion does not necessarily apply, which I will return to. So we get this canonical picture of the evolution of the universe. Some kind of start which we don't understand, inflation with quantum fluctuations, decoupling, the dark ages until the first stars form, the development of galaxies, planets, and so on. This is all, so you have your radiation-dominated era before decoupling, you have your matter-dominated era after, and eventually a dark energy or cosmological constant-dominated era, age about 13.7 billion years. And that's the canonical picture, which is supported by many, many observations. And the dynamics is general relativity. Perhaps I should just emphasize, if we go back to those equations, the key thing in there is the rho plus p, and that doesn't look like a huge change, but that is a huge change. That's what makes the difference between the Newtonian theory and the general relativity theory. I haven't written down the Ray-Chaudhry equation, but in the Ray-Chaudhry equation, there's rho plus 3p. You'll get the Ray-Chaudhry equation by taking the derivative of the Friedmann equation using conservation, and the rho plus 3p comes in, which is the quintessential general relativity factor. Okay, now, there's been these unifications, and the first unification was gravitation. And the gravitation, of course, started off apples falling in the garden, extended to the motion of the moon around the earth, then to the earth around the sun. It goes on as it is extended to the expansion of the universe. So the first unification is the force of the gravitation in the solar system to the scale of cosmology. And I said that was first Einstein and then Friedman. And so the unification is apple to the moon to the universe, and the Hubble diagram is what that shows us. The second unification was atomic physics. And that is when you have the equilibrium at early time, the decoupling at later time with the black band radiation beginning off. The cosmic background radiation spectrum is the evidence of this unification. And so you have the Planck black body cosmic background radiation. So the second one is the atomic physics unification to the scale of the universe. The third is the nuclear physics one, when nuclear synthesis took place, giving you the element abundances. And that unifies what happens in nuclear reactors, where you can test the nuclear reaction rates to nuclear synthesis. So these are the great unifications. Now, inflation was supposed to give us a unification of particle physics with cosmology, and it leads to the prediction of the CBR and isotropies and so on. But it hasn't quite worked. In fact, if you look at the inflation literature, what you've got is a lot of phenomenology going on, and virtually none of that phenomenology has any relation to real physics. The only case in which this is a true link is if the inflaton is the Higgs particle. And in that case, you have got a link from well-established particle physics to cosmology. Now, there's quite a lot of work going on this at the moment in the Encyclopedia Inflationaris. The Higgs inflation, as the inflaton is found to be one of the viable candidates, provided you have a non-minimal linking between the particle field and the curvature. And I know that there may be problems with this, but I've written about this with Jean-Philippe Guzan in an article that I quote there. It is just all the difference in the world. If the Higgs is the inflaton, there's a huge amount of data about the Higgs. There's one coupling constant, and then you've got this wonderful link from particle physics to astrophysics. Otherwise, you've got this slew of 150 or 200 inflationary models, and none of the rest of them have a proper foundation in particle physics. Mm. Quantum gravity. Was there a start? Was there a bounce? Did we emerge from a quite different kind of era? And we run here into the limits of the testing of physics. So in principle, quantum gravity is linked into the nature of the foundation of the universe, but in practice we do not know what that took place. And of course, Abbe and other people have got ideas which we will be hearing about here. But from my viewpoint, we hit the limits of tested physics. The thing is, if you look down that list, the first, the second, the third are well-tested physics. The fourth, we are on the limits of testing today because the Higgs was only just discovered last year. And the fifth one, we are probably at the limits of what might ever be tested. Okay, now the observational context, we can only observe on the past light cone. So using nice conformal coordinates, we're here and now, we look back to the surface of last scattering. Some distant galaxy we see at the moment it crosses our past light cone. The last scattering surface is the furthest that we can see. There's this. So the furthest matter we can see, the visual horizon, is the set of world lines of matter, which is the furthest matter we can see. We can, in principle, see any matter this side of the visual horizon, and we cannot see any matter by electromagnetic radiation the other side. This is the fundamental limit on all of observational cosmology. Gravitational waves will take us a little bit further, but nevertheless, they too have a horizon. There's a horizon for gravitational waves as well. And so the fundamental point about the universe, unless it is a small universe, and I have for many years been hoping we would prove it is a small universe, in other words, you keep going that way and eventually you'll come back that way, on a scale which we can have seen around since decoupling. In other words, we will see multiple images of the same galaxies in the sky. Now that is perfectly possible. From a general relativity viewpoint, it's an empirical question whether that is true or not, and it appears regrettably that it may not be true, although the door is not completely locked. The stuff before the surface of last scattering is hidden because electromagnetic radiation can't penetrate there. The start of the universe down there, we have no direct observational evidence. What we do have evidence of is if you follow our world line down to very early times, nucleosynthesis took place there, other stuff, baryosynthesis took place there, and we have got evidence today about what took place down there because we've got the remnants sitting here in this room. And so we do have evidence not only down the past light cone but also down our past world line, and that's what one might call geological type of evidence as opposed to observational type of evidence. Now, the CMB2 sphere is where our past light cone intersects the last scattering surface. So when you look at that picture here, what you are seeing is that CMB2 sphere. You are seeing the CMB2 sphere down there. And what I want to emphasize, you're seeing all those fluctuations over there which are going to grow into huge clusters of galaxies and so on. We can't today see the matter which was down there then. That matter surrounds us now in this huge sphere, and we do not know today what the state of that matter is. We only know what the state of the matter is which is near us. And so one of the fundamental limits is that we can see that stuff and we can guess what has happened to it, but we can't prove what's happened to it because we can't see it today. Okay. There's this anisotropy of one part in 100,000, the primordial fluctuations. Now, with GR and cosmology, the issue comes up is the testability of theories about the universe in the large. And of course, the big thing which has been pushed here in recent times is the idea of the multiverse, that there is this domain which we can see down to the last scattering surface with all of these galaxies expanding in the way we all know. But the idea that there are other bubbles out there. Now, of course, nobody believes that the universe comes to an end when you hit the last part we can see. Of course, it continues beyond. But we don't know what is beyond there, and there are these speculations. Now, when I was a student, the speculation was that the universe continued exactly unchanged forever. That was the cosmological principle, which Hermann Bondi and other people made a foundational principle of cosmology. And in fact, in Steven Weinberg's book in 1973, he has a whole section defending the cosmological principle and saying why it was an indubitable principle of the nature of the universe. Mm-hmm. Since inflation has come in, of course, some people think there might be bubbles of other type of matter out there. Now, the fact of the matter is you can't observationally tell which of those is true because of these horizons out there. Unless there are some of these collisions, but the thing about those collisions between the bubbles is they'll only occur in some inflationary models and not in all inflationary models, if that is the kind of inflation which produces bubbles, and not all kinds of inflation do produce bubbles. Now, physicists are straining to say they can solve this issue of geometry beyond the horizon and the origins of the universe purely through physics. Lawrence Krauss's book is perhaps an example of this, but there's a large element of wishful thinking in these claims, which we can talk about. So just to emphasize this again, this is a diagram. This is the real scale of the universe, as shown by Mark Whittle. So this is not co-moving, this is real size, and the last pass light cone goes out and focuses back in because the gravitational field pulls it back in. If you think of this going backwards in time, the whole universe acts as a giant gravitational lens, and every galaxy beyond the maximal point there is expanded and looks bigger than it ought to look for its distance because the entire universe is acting as a gravitational lens, which is something which Fred Hoyle first pointed out in about 1916. You see the galaxy world lines going out as t to the 2/3, and that's the real situation in terms of real distance and real time, but we can't see the causal structure. So we go to the causal diagram where we now are using co-moving coordinates and conformal time. And this enables us to see very clearly the particle horizon on the left, which I've already talked about. You can see a galaxy there in the middle with co-moving coordinates. You can see when we can see it. And what this makes clear, that's the visual horizon. It's the furthest galaxy we can see. That is the entire observable universe. And we can't see anything outside that. Now, people are talking about the universe extending to infinity and structures out to infinity and so on. I want to emphasize here, let's look at this on a slightly better scale. That's the entire observable universe. Some of our colleagues are extrapolating to way, way beyond out there. In fact, let's look at it with an even. There is no observational data whatever about what happens out there. And when people confidently tell you what's going out there, not out there, they can't verify what they are saying. Now, at a better scale, let's look at it like that. And what's happened, all the data we will ever get lie within that little domain there. And so these confident statements about infinities out there with identical copies of you and me saying stuff to each other out there is just pure imagination. If you could prove the physics was such as to create all of these other bubbles and so on, it still depends on the initial conditions, but you can't prove the physics is like that because the physics is also untested and unverified. You can make any claim you like about what goes out there and it cannot be proved or disproved. And this is, to me, one of the things which you may have seen the article Joe Silk and I did about this in Nature a while ago, and in fact we're going to have a meeting in Munich about this later this year. We think it's important to defend the integrity of science, that the core essence of science is that the claims you are making are in some sense or other testable, and if they aren't, there's nothing wrong with having speculations about what is out there, but you must label them as that speculations. Mm-hmm. So the limits, what about the colliders? Will we ever be able to test the physics? Well, we're going up to 15 TeV, but the Planck energy is hugely bigger than that. We're never going to be able to test those energies. We've got the visual and causal horizons, and I believe quite strongly in what Bill McRae said in the 1970s. Just as there's an uncertainty principle at the micro scale, there's an uncertainty principle, a corresponding one, at the macro scale. There are going to be limits of our certainty and cosmology as well, dual to the micro one. And that little paper by Mel McRae in Nature is a very nice paper on this. We're soon going to have seen all that we can see. Of course, the gravitational waves is the one big one that will come up. It'll take us further, but still, there is also a horizon for gravitational waves as well. Okay. Now, one very interesting development has taken place, which to me is really quite unexpected. It's turned out that our best limitation on cosmological models come not through observation directly testing space-time structure, but rather from observations related to structure formation in the early universe. So the whole of the Sandage program and the supernova program is based on seeing standard candles and testing the background geometry directly by the way that geodesics focus in the standard model, and it relies on your standard candles, or possibly number counts, if you could get the number counts under control. Now, the problem with this is multiple, and the problem is that you have to be very, very careful indeed that your standard candle is a standard candle. There still is a lingering worry about the supernovae. If the metallicity is different down in some of those distant supernovae than here, could their brightness be different than nearby ones? And we do not still have a really good theory of how supernova explosions take place of sufficient accuracy to be able to check that. But in any case, as I've said, in fact, the real thing which has turned out, which is quite a surprise, is it's the inhomogeneities which allow you to do the best test. And that's allows us to use cosmic background anisotropy observations to place constraints on particle physics models. And in fact, the Planck satellite has been used. If you look at this paper called the Encyclopedia Inflationaris, what you can see there is that some particle physics models for what might be taking place are constrained by observations of the Planck satellite, which is a really extraordinary development. Furthermore, cosmological observations can be used to test deviations from general relativity theory and proposals for alternative theories. So I'll say a bit about each of these. So the key feature is basic structure formation. You've got your linearly perturbed Roberts and Walker models at early times, which goes back, as I said, to Lifshitz, and then to Sachs and Wolff, and many other people, and then numerical simulations at later time. And you have this idea, quantum fluctuations, inflation, generate inhomogeneities, that through a process of expansion of the Hubble radius contraction, I'm not going to go into that, seed acoustic waves in the hot Big Bang era, so there are these waves taking place. These produce a pattern of fluctuations on the last scattering surface that are then the seeds for gravitational instability to generate structures. And this is a wonderful theory. And I must emphasize with this, the predictions of this theory were made before the cosmic background radiation power spectrum was measured. And in terms of scientific theories, predicting stuff and then measurement taking place, this is a huge success. This gives the best test of inflationary cosmological models. And so you've got your spectrum, you've got the COBE one on the top, the WMAP one there, and you do the power spectrum there, and you get the theoretical curve, which fits the data beautifully, provided you tune about three parameters, which is the baryon density and the Hubble constant, and the dark energy, the cosmological constant. Now there's a little bit of worry on the far left. The very large angular scales are on the left, and the very small angular scales on the right. But you then run into what's called cosmic variance. Your theory produces statistical predictions, but we're looking at one universe. And the question is the one universe a good representative of the statistical family of models that you've got? And you end up with a subtle discussion of probabilities. Anyhow, in this model, the dark matter density is 0.3, cosmological constant about 0.7, they add up to a flat background model. And the background radiation agrees with lensing and the matter power spectrum and the velocities. It is a package which works very, very well, a huge triumph. And the general relativity is crucial to this in terms both of the background model and the perturbations, because the perturbations also obey relativistic equations at early times. So you've got your baryonic, the power spectrum of on the left of matter perturbations, and you see that this is Tegmark's map. It's a very, very good map. On the left are the limits on the power spectrum we got from the cosmic background measurements, then the SDSS measurements are the black ones, weak lensing is the purple ones, and the Lyman alpha forest is the red ones, and you get this curve of the fluctuations of matter. On the right is the baryon acoustic oscillations, the co-moving separation, and the correlation function, and you get this peaks. And what this peak is, it's the matter version of the peak that's in you've got that peak there, which is the peak in the microwave background, which says if you analyze that, there are preferred scales in there. It's not obvious to the eye, but there are preferred scales. In particular, there's a Biggs peak and then a couple of later peaks. And if you look at the matter spectrum, you see exactly the same peak there, because the fluctuations which were produced, the spectrum of perturbations on the last scattering surface also produced the fluctuations of the matter. So the point I'm wanting to make now, dark energy and dark matter with an almost flat universe, is the famous diagram here. And the thing is, the supernova by themselves test the background model. And this is the extension of Hubble's program and Sandage's program, and that's what you get there. If that is all that you had, you would have very, very weak limits on the cosmology. You wouldn't know if the cosmological constant was 1.2 down to 0.4. You would think it was positive. You bring in the W map here, and you bring in the galaxy cluster. Those are both based on the observations of the perturbation spectrum, and so it's the perturbations which are, in fact, giving you the links, the strong links, and giving you this small point where they all coincide. And so this is the fact which I've been trying to say, which to me is really very, very unexpected. In the old days, we were always thinking of testing the model directly by number counts or by standard candles, and that's what Sandage's great paper is about, and it's turned out that's not the best way to test the models. This is the best way to test the models. Okay, now, there is a big question there. Is dark energy a result of inhomogeneity? Because all of those analyses assumed a Robertson-Orca background, but we only see down the past light cone, and it is possible that what you're seeing is not a variation in time, but a variation in space. It's possible that we are, in fact, at the center of the universe with a great big inhomogeneity around us. Now, this is philosophically a very unpopular position at the present time. Of course, it was very popular in old time. But whether we like it or not, it's a very important question to ask. Is the Copernican principle true, that we are not at the center of the universe, that the whole universe is, that basically everywhere is the same? Now, I used to think that this was not a testable proposition. I used to think that this was a philosophical thing which couldn't be tested. In fact, there's a theorem. The background model can be fitted by an inhomogeneous L to V model for any value of the cosmological constant for any source of evolution. You can take any data you like for the supernova and for number counts, and you can fit it by an inhomogeneous model where we are at the center of a large underdensity. And for a long time, I thought this theorem meant that we were never going to be able to prove that the universe was spatially homogeneous, basically because, as I said, you can fit any of the data. So we could fit the supernova observation, would seem to tell you lambda is positive, by an inhomogeneous model with lambda is zero. But it turns out the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect says that is not the case. Another thing you can look for to test for inhomogeneity is elements. And I just want to point out here, I've already mentioned nuclear synthesis, helium here, and now test nuclear synthesis down there. If you can measure helium abundances far out, you can test nuclear synthesis far out, and that's a way of testing inhomogeneity in the universe like that. The kinematic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, we're here and now, and what happens is we've got the CMB2 sphere. What happens is matter out there scatters incoming microwave background radiation, and so incoming microwave background radiation gets scattered there. If the temperature there is different from the temperature there, it distorts the spectrum here, and we can measure it up here, and deduce that down there they were receiving an isotropic spectrum of cosmic background radiation, and that is the way that we can test most effectively that the universe in fact satisfies the Copernican principle, and that the Robertson-Walker model is a good model, and therefore we are not measuring an inhomogeneity, we are measuring a dark energy. And the interesting point about this also is that if we think just of the light cone, and this is all that we can see, but in fact this is probing the interior of the light cone, it's probing some of those interior parts which are not actually directly observable by us. Is dark energy a result of altered field equations? Perhaps. One of the things, we test the Einsteinic field equations to great, great accuracy, Clifford Wurrill will tell you all about that, at the scale of the solar system. Does it still hold on much larger scales? Does it hold on the scale of cosmology? Well, this is under intense investigation. And so people are looking whether you can use altered field equations to explain this rather than dark energy. But you can invert the logic and use cosmological observations to test the validity of GR on these larger scales. And I'll just mention here, a meeting, for instance, testing general relativity with cosmology held at the Royal Society, Chichley Hall. If general relativity holds true, then the majority of the universe's matter is exotic and unknown because of the dark energy and the dark matter. With current developments in theoretical physics, alternatives to theory have begun to emerge. Furthermore, the coming decade promises wide-ranging, cutting-edge experiments on cosmic scales. For the first time in almost a century, we will begin to test Einstein's theory and his rivals by computing them to our ever more precise understanding of the universe. And at that paper, you had Rachel Bean, Edmund Birchinger, Kitching, Ozan, and so on, talking about the different ways of constraining testing Einstein field equations on a cosmological scale. So, for instance, Birchinger was talking about one gravitational potential or two. Thomas Kitchen was talking about testing modified gravity with weak lensing experiments, and so on. You can download these papers for yourself if you want to look at them. Redshift space distortions is one other way of looking at this. Jacob Bekenstein talking about tensor vector scalar modified gravity from small scale to cosmology. And Glenn Starkman saying you can't always get what you want, and so on. Roy Martens was talking about this issue I've just mentioned, is the universe homogeneous, and so on. And this is from the webpage of the Institute of Cosmology and Gravity at Portsmouth. They talk about testing gravity on various scales. The vertical axis is space-time curvature, the horizontal is the gravitational potential, the blue dotted lines indicate typical length scales, and the solar system ones are all up at the top, the cosmology ones can test down in the lower areas down there. And so these on the right will be the dark energy survey, the baryon oscillation spectroscopic survey, the mapping nearby galaxies at APO, and so on. The Euclid mission, all of these missions are going up and will be testing general relativity. One of the things that we'll be trying to do is test general relativity on the cosmological scale.
You should be finishing up.
Okay, I've got two final slides. The first is the effective domain of dependence. And because we're relativists, we like to talk about the past light cone, and we like to think that that is the domain of dependence. However, that isn't really what matters. If you ask, what matters in cosmology for what is happening in this room, the past light cone is irrelevant. What matters is a very, very small co-moving sphere around us, which we call the physical horizon. In fact, if you surround us by a curving sphere of about 1 megaparsec, that is the domain which actually affects us in this room. And that's because the characteristics of what happens there are time-like world lines. Matter does not move on null rays, it moves on time-like world lines. And so although I've spent a great deal of time talking about the particle horizon, visual horizon, in fact, what matters in terms of the physics of what's going on in the solar system or in our galaxy is a very, very much smaller part of the universe, and the Hubble radius is irrelevant to what's happening here and now. And the final thing is the key unsolved issue. You've got your quantum fluctuations, which lead to classical fluctuations. We have no coherent theory of how the quantum fluctuations change to classical fluctuations. And this is one of the biggest problems with inflationary theory, which people do not talk about. Some people claim decoherence will do it, I claim not. Some people say collapse might do it, and I think that might work. Some people say the pilot wave theory of Bohm might be a solution, and that's actually a very interesting thing that might solve it. So there are various kinds of possibilities, but until we have a theory how the quantum fluctuations become classical, we do not have a coherent theory of cosmology, starting off with quantum fluctuations and leading to those perturbations we see today. So then this famous cartoon, I think you should be a little bit more explicit here. How does the quantum to classical transition take place? It is the missing part of this picture, which I've been putting forward.
Okay, so we'll move directly on to the next talk and of course do all the questions and discussion after the coffee break.